Hello, my name is Ronan Winter. I'm a third-year artificial intelligence student in the University of Groningen.
Hi guys, my name is John. I'm a third-year international and European law student at Ruch as well.
Yeah. And yeah, so welcome to our podcast. First of all, we would like to discuss a little bit about, yeah, like coming up with the idea of our podcast and where did it come from.
Right. The first time we thought about the podcast was actually a funny time. I generally go to Ron's house, right? I come like, what, once a week?
Yeah.
Yeah, like something like once a week to discuss.
One or two times, yeah.
Like, sometimes it's more frequent than that, sometimes it's less frequent than that. Remember we had like a hiatus of like 3 months or something? A month, yeah? From July to August.
Yeah.
It depends. To just enjoy ourselves, listen to music.
Smoking some herb.
Yeah, smoking some herb, and like oregano, for those who are in Indonesia or whatever, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, during these times, we tend to have these lively discussions regarding a lot of different topics, right? Regarding philosophy, regarding current global affairs.
Right.
And also, yeah, just of human nature and the human condition.
Definitely, definitely. And it's funny how I come from a social background and Ron comes from like a science background, would you say?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And it converges on our weekly talk.
Yeah.
And it's nice.
Yeah. And we learn a lot from each other based on each other's knowledge. But it tends to like combine in a controlled, chaotic manner. Definitely. Right? And it tends to focus on these certain tropes and these certain topics, which I mentioned before.
Right.
And on that basis, yeah, and that's why, like, we wanted to have a platform to share with the world regarding these conversations, right, these lively conversations that we have. Mm-hmm. And what the podcast will primarily be about is that we're going to be discussing the absurdity of existence, so sort of like a dive into human nature and the human condition. Mm. And we're also going to be talking about the ongoing political and socioeconomic narratives and affairs that need some further importance and further highlighting.
Right.
And we're also going to be discussing like the unraveling of the illusory figment that we call reality and why it's illusory. It's because it's reality, and how we view reality is sort of a model, right? Mm. And it's, we're going to further discuss why we think reality is a model and why we view and how reality to us is sort of an illusion in a sense. And yeah, and now we're gonna talk about the values of the podcast.
Right. So initially, the reason why we're in school is not so much learning our topics or our discipline, but it's more about how we model our mind towards how we perceive studying, I think. Because that's one of the core values of the podcast, which is, in other words, critical thinking.
Yeah.
I think we spend most of our times in university to actually model our minds on how to think. Rather than actually learning from the topics. Because you can do that through the internet, no?
Yeah, exactly. And we have, like, yeah, this wealth of information available to us. Mm-hmm. And we sort of want to find a way in order to capture the signal from the noise that's present, right? And we sort of want to combine, like, our intellectual curiosity and our interests in this format, in this lively, open, easygoing discussion where we talk about a lot of different interesting topics.
And also with that, an essential part of it is also from a bottom-up approach. It also ties into the easygoing and chill vibe and other values of this podcast, because through discussing big abstract concepts through our bottom-up approach of how we take on our daily task and day-to-day life, it's much more adhere to the common man.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
So they know our struggles and things like that. And through struggles builds, you know, knowledge and subjective knowledge, at least from our perspective. So you could relate more.
Yeah. And by honing in that curiosity and stemming a discussion from that, we're sort of embracing our ignorance in a lot of ways. Because ultimately, yeah, like humans itself and we ourselves as well are ignorant on a lot of on a lot of things that are relevant to our minds.
We sort of instill our own bias.
Yeah, we instill our own bias. And then by this discussion, we start to recognize what our different biases are and what we can learn from each other in building like this core of our knowledge and stemming a discussion from that.
True.
Yeah. So that was the information regarding our podcast. Right. And now we'll be discussing more about like we, the hosts, and our a little bit about ourselves regarding our background and our upbringing. And yeah, so John, talk about a little bit about your upbringing.
Okay. So I think we share a similarity there, that we're both half Indonesian and also half, let's say, Western.
Yeah.
Right? But from different parts of Indonesia, right, Ron? Like, I come from a bigger city called Jakarta. You come from Jogja, right, Ron?
Yeah.
And it actually is interesting how, even though we live in Indonesia as a whole, we live in different sections, so we bring on a different perspective on how we perceive Indonesia and its, let's say, cultural beings, happenings, and also actually the world.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, we're both half Indonesian, but it doesn't necessarily mean to say that we're tied in down to the same doctrines because of our region.
No, exactly. And our hometowns and where we grew up, they're very different from each other.
Right.
And for example, John's hometown, Jakarta, it's very much a metropolis. There's a lot of hustle and bustle, a lot of traffic, a lot of affairs, business going on. It's the capital of Indonesia. Right. That's where everything stems, and
it's one of the mega cities of the world, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of the most populous cities in the world.
Right.
Right. And it's quite a stark contrast to how Jogja is.
Right.
And Jogja is more of a cultural heart of Indonesia.
Definitely.
And sort of why it came to be that way is because it's sort of designated as a special region of Indonesia because it has its own leader who consults with the president, and the leader is a sultan.
And they have like special legislative and administrative capabilities. They can have their own special rules, which does not also apply to Jakarta.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. That's why I think, and also its geographical location. If you think about it, it's right in between.
Yeah.
It's near the sea, and it's right in the middle. If you took Jakarta and you enlarged it to a map and you found the middle, it's sort of... Sorry, Indonesia.
Yeah.
It's sort of in the middle, man. And a lot of students go there because, I don't know, it's cultural. They're very accepting. It's perhaps partly because of the fact that it's a special region.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Despite us being from different cities, we grew up in quite a similar manner. Mm-hmm. Our upbringing was quite similar in that the both of us, we went to an international school, right? And primarily that's because we are also multinational and intercultural.
Mm-hmm.
So our minds are also shaped by this upbringing, by this international environment that we were in.
Agreed. I think also because the reason why I'd say an international school has some more points that are positive compared to, like, let's say a national school that you find in Indonesia, like, or a public school internationally, is because you have a different set of people that come from various different backgrounds and from all corners of the world. And regardless of which international school you are in the world, I'm sure they have this sort of diversity and nationality. And I think that at least, helped me to develop much more critical thinking as one of the values. But anyways, that's not your point. Go on.
Why don't you further elaborate on also your interests, right? And maybe also like how they were shaped during your upbringing, and also sort of what has changed, right? What has changed from your interests from before, back when you were in Indonesia, and how your interests changed now when you're studying here in the Netherlands?
Right. I think I got a first taste of actually how to think, or as we call it, critical thinking. I'm not trying to promote it or anything, but I had a first taste in actually high school, because I was part of this program called International Baccalaureate. So I was as well.
Yeah. So that's why. That's another similarity that we have.
Exactly. Right. Not promoting IB schools, by the way. Sometimes they do some crazy stuff to students that it's like, you know, obviously you don't want to get yourself into that shit.
Bro. Yeah.
You're still like 15 and stuff.
There's quite a lot of workload.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Also, anyways, I'm not trying to, that was just a down point of IB. I'm not, just to justify why, I'm not really promoting it in any sense, shape or form. There's like positives and negatives, but in IB, I actually, we were taught TOK, man.
Remember? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
Theory of knowledge.
Theory of knowledge. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was when I got really hooked into not really philosophers, but that style of thinking, you know, connecting different disciplines.
No, like exactly. Art, exactly.
Things like that into one thing. And that's when I got first hooked to philosophy, but at such a elementary level.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's what's interesting about that course, TOK, Theory of Knowledge, is that it takes all these different disciplines, right? Mm. It takes science, it takes like natural science, it takes social sciences, it takes art, it takes music, it takes sport, and it takes all the fundamentals, right? Sees and it tries to sort of like piece back together into what are actually the fundamentals of that. Right, where do those fundamentals come from? And that all boils down to philosophy, which is like, how these concepts are born, and how our knowledge is changed in between each discipline, how our knowledge is obtained in each discipline.
Right. Because I think it also acknowledges TOK when you were talking about discipline, that if you strip things down to the fundamental, that's when you can find relation to one subject and the other.
Exactly.
Because within that subject, the abstractness of the topic gets to an extreme.
You know,
where some, you know, it's you really have to dive into that.
No,
And when you strip it down to its fundamentals, it's beautiful, bro.
Yeah, and it sort of unravels sort of the abstractions of reality that we have.
True.
Right? Because we have science, right? And science is... and particularly the natural sciences, the abstraction of reality is much more at a lower level, right? It's more dealing with the physical structures and physical objects, right? In physics, for example, or in your biology, in terms of like how organisms are structured.
Right.
But then, and then you can look at a higher level. If you look at the social sciences, it's at a much higher level. And that's sort of the interesting thing. You start to trace back, right? Back like how all of these systems develop and what's its ultimate goal. And the ultimate goal, right, is for us to obtain knowledge, right? Knowledge of the world.
I agree. And that's actually a part of universality as well that we've always been accustomed to since that international school environment. You know, that universality of thought where you can't really have much prejudice to people, because you see differences every day in the classroom. People come in and out from different countries. You might not have a friend as long as what, like 2 months, bro, because the next semester they might be gone, you know, and then someone else comes in, fills the spot, that's a different nationality than the previous person, and so on and so forth. It's very perpetual that you always get different nationalities, you're always bombarded with differences from an early age. And to be fair, it makes you want to break out of your shell, you know?
Yeah, it sort of wants to make you embrace your ignorance, right? Because, we all have these biases, these ingrained desires and these ingrained biases upon people, personality, nationality, concepts, and all those sort of things. And this environment that we grew up in, it sort of stimulated us in order to break down these barriers. And that's also what TOK taught. It sort of broke down the barriers of disciplines and sort of put them in a sort of hierarchy, right? Sort of, yeah, like what I said before, sort of like layers of abstraction, right?
Because like now I'm a university student, but I can look back at TOK's style of teaching, of breaking it down and things like that. No barriers between disciplines. Now I can see it actually now as a law student, that there are some things in our discipline you cannot break or go against.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I'm actually thinking about it twice. I'm not sure about science, but at least for us, there are some things momentarily that can have an antithesis. For instance, like preemptory norms. You can't commit torture.
No, and that's what's interesting. And because the reason why law, for example, is quite rigid in that way, it's because there's more constraints, right? There's more constraints in order for it to be a working system, right? Compared to science. Science has less constraints, right? The constraints are based on the environment, right? And there, it's a lot more subject to change, right? And it's a lot more subject to falsifying that, the theories and thoughts in that, which is different from law because it's in a higher layer of reality.
Right. But this is what I think actually on that topic as well. So I was thinking of that actually. With law, it's a study that's very dependent on human interaction, right? It's a social study. So it depends on human interaction.
Yeah.
But as things in life in general, in the world, material and non-material, getting more and more complex, we find that stuff is customs. That's what they say in law.
Yeah.
So it's like a general practice that has been believed by all as the law. That's a custom.
No, exactly.
Right.
And it's
that exists between people, right? And the culture is based off a custom. And law writes about customs and lives off these human interactions that create binding obligations which are sometimes unspoken. So that's the law basis, right? And I'm thinking that now, because people are getting more complex in general, law is gonna change much more quicker in general. So it'll be calculated or acted upon as also a science, man. What do you think of AI in the courtroom and things like that? So it's becoming much and more also within law to think outside the box. To think outside the box of, for instance, you can go against that law. But stuff is getting much and more fluid, man. Before, which took hundreds and thousands of years. No, that's too much. Like 100 years. I think like 100 years. Before digital age, law before was much more stagnant, man.
Yeah,
because less globalization, less customs coming into one another, less chance of human interactions to be much more complex.
Yeah, and like these customs, right? These customs that law endorses and law regulates, it sort of stems back into religion, right? How religion sort of served as a platform in order to tie in our duty,
right?
In order for us how to conduct ourselves in society, how to treat one another,
right?
And that was controlled and propagated by the myths of religion,
of course.
And that's sort of similar to law, because law is also a myth. In my opinion, it's also a myth, right? That stems from religion, right?
Right.
But since it's at a lower layer of reality than religion, it's more involved with the processes of life, right? Which is human interaction. Religion is less so, but it's still involved.
Right.
Right.
I agree. That's why in law they always make comparisons between law and religion, that they're symbiotic to one another. They learn from one another.
Yeah.
They take lessons from one another. That's why it can be said, rather this is pretty much extreme, because it throws religion out the window completely. Because now you have, like, for instance, studies that actually puts faith into consideration. Faith, not purely faith, but stemming from religion, like logotherapy, for instance.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's besides the point. But the point, what I'm trying to make is... What was I trying to make, bro? All right, I'll leave it off at logotherapy.
Bro. Okay, no, but something interesting, right? You talked about faith, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of, yeah, you have faith in religion, right? You have faith that, yeah, that these certain things are true, right?
Right.
And it's the same with law. You have faith, right? You have faith that, okay, this conceptual system that humankind has created, which is law, mm-hmm. you believe in it. You sort of have faith in it, right? And yeah, and that's why you have this similarity between faith and of faith in religion and law. But since I mentioned before, because law is at a lower layer than religion, you have less faith in it. It's there's less constraints, right, in order to make it work rather than religion.
Actually, that brings an interesting point, because to a large extent, actually, religion is non-material. It's intangible.
Yeah.
And faith, actually.
And it's the same with law. It's sort of intangible as well.
Right.
But it's less.
It's less. You have judges who speak.
Yeah, law, exactly. It's more, you can see it. It's more tangible than religion, for example.
Right. Because it's tangible. It's more tangible in the sense that if you want to go against the law or find loopholes around it, you might do it in a material way. You can see the judge. You can feel the judge.
Yeah,
you
know, through human interaction.
Through human interaction.
Yeah.
With religion, it's sort of you're tossing a ball in the air. You don't know when it'll fall. You don't know if a bird will hit into the ball. You don't know if the wind strikes away.
No, what I'm saying is you have faith, right?
You have faith. And which covers the uncertainty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I guess now I can ask, during your personal development, what were your inspirations?
Right.
And what insights, what valuable insights you've obtained from them?
That's true. Throughout high school, actually, and then throughout my schooling years before pre-university, I was actually really adamant towards sports. I considered it quite large in my life. And I actually swam first and then went on to do different sports throughout my high schooling years. I learned a lot of values from it. But that'll be discussed later. So that's where I got my first idea for an inspiration or an idol. I always looked at sporting figures.
Yeah.
At first. Like the likes of Messi, for instance. Like, he's got a banger left foot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And different players in football and basketball and rugby and things like that. And then there was a segue from that led into my other interest in idols that's outside the scope of sports. For instance, those sporting athletes who served as the segue that ended up to do some good or to be a politician or to be such a public figure. That's when the next interest came in, actually. So, that segued me from sporting idols to much more... idols who are not just introduced in the field of sport, but politics, or philanthropy and stuff like that, and that was helping the common good. That's actually which stemmed my first idea of a potential major in university. That's why I always wanted to be a doctor at first, because I stripped down the fundamentals of these guys, and they just want to entertain, they just want to do good, you know.
Yeah, it's this dedication, right? It's this dedication to the art form, right?
Right.
Of sport, because I consider it as a sort of art, right? Right,
definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. It's beautiful when you see it play. The movements of your muscles,
exactly.
The left and right foot coordination. It's sort of like an art. It's a dance.
Exactly, because what's interesting is that you have all these constraints, right? You have all these rules within each sport, right? But then you have the creative freedom in order to mitigate those constraints, to find sort of a perfect dance.
A silver lining to all the mundaneness.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why figures such as Messi is very inspirational, right? Mm. Because he's able to find sort of like a super intelligence in this domain, right?
Right.
Where he's able to show his creative freedom that completely changes how we perceive the game.
Right, definitely. It's as if you see these players as a, you're in a cave, you're in prison.
Yeah.
You're meant to be in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And you look up on the wall and you see a crack, an aperture through the wall, and you see light peering.
Yeah.
You know? you're going to be creative in the way to reach that hole. You know, you're going to scale the walls. You're going to break, you know, the footing of your bed to make the bed, you know, get the chair involved and things. You got to be creative in order to see that crack through the hole with the light.
Yeah.
Because you thought you were in solitary confinement and you see a football field. Beyond that, through that crack, you see a football field.
Okay.
And you see the likes of Messi dancing right. with the ball.
Interesting.
Passes it off to Maradona. Yeah. You know? Yeah. What I'm saying is these guys feature brilliances that are just out of the ordinary. And you're always attracted to things which are absurd, for instance.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because you find that, wow, like, this is unreal. You've never seen that in your life. And then, bang, you see this guy play beautifully.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting. They sort of tap into this Zen state, right? They sort of tap into this balance between order and disorder, right? And that's that silver lining, right? It's like in Taoism, right? You have the yin and the yang, and you have, and it sort of mixes into
the white and the white and the black.
Yeah,
balanced,
but not too much, right? Yeah. You want it to be balanced,
right?
And that's where you can find beauty. It's in this balance.
Definitely. Right. Yeah, I do agree. And then and actually, yeah, so it was sporting idols. And then I actually went on, shout out to my friend Rehan Rahman, to what you were talking about, balance and you know, finding the beauty within the silver lining, you know, a wrestle between good and bad. So my friend Rehan Rahman, he introduced me, I haven't told you this, to yoga. To Isha Sun yoga. And there was a certain person that actually inspired me. His name is Sadhguru. I don't know if you know Sadhguru.
No.
He's like a leader of this yoga that's called Isha Sun yoga or something. But it's under Sadhguru, so I might get the name wrong. But Sadhguru, I know the man's a legend, I think. That's right. Anyway, so I was inspired by these figures that are like much more, you know, look at life differently. Like, you know, he said something like, once you meditate enough, you can even see nature vibrate. You know, it's very out of the ordinary.
No, and it's sort of those practices, it sort of taps into your primary consciousness, your primary awareness. It teaches you how to be fully aware of the present moment, right? Mm. It sort of achieves like this flow state where you're in perfect harmony, you find inner peace within your conscious experience.
Mm. I agree. And these guys helped me do that. I mean, you have figures of your own. Maybe later after this, you'll end up discussing them.
Yeah.
I know a few. That, you know, we've always discussed them as well. But, yeah. So, that's why these guys also came into the foreground of my preferred idols. So, Sadhguru. I was rather like a silent majority on it. Because, you know, I don't know how my friend, the boys, would feel if I was like, hey man, I'm a yogi. So, back then, I was pressured not to say things to expose my... Yeah. I thought that statement would make me vulnerable.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was my thought back then.
Yeah.
Probably some of you guys could relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So Sadhguru was quite an idol. And I practiced his yoga and things like that. And it brought me some clarity. Even though a week after, I stopped practicing yoga. After that class with Rehan Rahman, who invited me. And I had to skip a rugby tournament for that, my friend. To skip that.
Yeah.
And then... do yoga instead. Can you imagine how much of a bro I am? Like, bro, fuck rugby, man. Rehan, let's go, man. Like, I'm about to hit the yoga with you, bro. You know? Yeah. You'll be chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff like that, bro. Yeah, so Sadhguru came into the foreground. That was back in high school. Not much figures, but more mostly sporting figures. Sadhguru. others as well, like Muhammad as well, like Prophet Muhammad. And then a lot of, you know, religious figures in Indonesia who like move non-NGOs who are affiliated to a religion. Like, for instance, Cak Nun. He's a Muslim preacher.
Okay.
But he tackles the question of religion with culture as well.
Mm.
So it's not always right, you know. Like, some things go above religion that's like part of human nature and stuff. Yeah. So he combines them both. So these idols also came to the foreground. That was back in high school. And then segue to university. Actually, and my idols now, I'd say. So these all of these, this, first of all, this is not an exhaustive list. Like, obviously there are some idols that I haven't placed, but some of prominence I've put there.
What come to mind, right?
Yeah, that what come to mind, basically. Yeah. And then in university, what came to mind were the likes of literary figures, man. Like Indonesian writers.
Yeah.
Who always, some way, had an interesting background. Like, they ended up being in such a, you know, shitty situation, like, digging their own grave. But then there's a silver lining of their work that makes them somewhat, like, impressive and prized upon. Like, for instance, Pramudia Anantatur. He's an Indonesian writer. This was, like, not even in the 2000s. This was way, way back. And he wrote a number of books, and he won the Nobel Prize of Literature. Like, in Indonesia, this guy and his works are studied in universities in America.
Yeah.
You know, and things like that. And he wrote a different number of influential books, which I do recommend, Bumi Manusia and things like that, that actually have an Indonesian diction that is very, very, very romantic. So the words are, you know, very, very precise and not vague, you know. They use sometimes, like, the word DNJ, like Digikarta, stuff like that. So it's very old Indonesian literature. So like Shakespeare, for instance, to Western readers.
Yeah.
You know, this is the Shakespeare of Indonesia, hands down. You know, and it's got into mainstream media now. A lot of musicians make music, like Jason Ranti. You know, he died, I think, not long ago. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, a lot of, like, the point is, a lot of these people actually appeared in the foreground in media and things like that. So he's not just like an icon in its discipline, but he's also an icon, you know, a pop icon.
Yeah, it permeates to relevant things today and important things today.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what's interesting when you were talking about your how your interest was shaped, because I sort of also had a similar experience in that like when I was younger, I was very much invested into sports.
Let's get it, bro.
Yeah.
It's our friends, man.
You know? Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah,
exactly, bro.
And especially football. Like, I was very invested in football. Right. I was a big football fan.
Mm.
And when I was younger...
You went to soccer school, right?
Yeah. And when I was younger, I also went to soccer school.
Mm.
Right? And
Real Madrid, bro.
Yeah.
How could you, man?
Real Madrid soccer school in Jogja.
That's a bad team. I support Barcelona. That is such a bad team, man. I don't know how you make a decision to support that team, but...
I didn't support them. I just played.
Nah, man. That's unconsciously supporting them. No. Your favorite player was from there, right? Ronaldo?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. My point and case there, bro. You can't get out of this, man. Go on.
Okay. Yeah, so I was very invested in sports, like, from as a child and also, like, my early teenage years. I was still very much invested in sports. But then I sort of had a shift. I sort of had a shift in my thinking and in the way, and also my personality, in the way I conduct myself. Right, and what stimulates my curiosity.
Right.
And yeah, so during high school, like maybe when I was 16, right, that shift in thinking for me first started off. And what instigated that change was basically I started becoming interested in books, in reading books, in trying to go out of my way, out of the syllabus and out of the content that I've been teaching in school, and try to find interesting insights that I can find. And one of those insights and one of those inspirations that really inspired me was the French-Algerian philosopher Albert Camus.
Right?
And yeah, and in that point, what's interesting is that I was interested in philosophy, right? And that stemmed from a theory of knowledge. And then I began being inquisitive of existentialism,
right?
And that first started off with nihilism, and one of the most popular figures in nihilism is Friedrich Nietzsche, right? But then, yeah, but then what I found, I couldn't really comprehend him. His language was quite difficult and very formal, it's hard to understand. But what I could understand from him is that he gave a very bleak viewpoint of life, right?
And isn't that one of like the main prerequisite of something being like existentialism?
Yeah. What isn't is
the fact that there's no faith?
Yeah, exactly, and that's why there's no hope. That's what it first stemmed, because he had this quote, right? He had this quote that God is dead, and what he meant by this is that the role that God used to play, a role that religion used to play, is gone. It's not the same anymore for society, and yeah, and it's sort of lost its role in grounding our existence, right? In trying to instill like this purpose and meaning into our existence,
right?
And that's what I obtained from him, right? Is that notion. And from that, right? From that, I tried to find other figures, right? And then I delved into Albert Camus and his philosophy of absurdism. And yeah, and that really inspired me in a way, because so his philosophy is that absurdism is that it revolves around the notion of the absurd, right? And the absurd is referring to like this conflict between the human tendency to seek inherent meaning in life, right? To seek this grounding of existence that Nietzsche was talking about that was gone from society, right? And the silent answer of the universe, right?
Right.
And the silent answer of the universe is what Nietzsche said, is that, yeah, God is dead. Now there's a silent answer of the universe in terms of what we want to ground our existence to.
Right.
And yeah, and then what he basically says is that existence is absurd, right? And it's absurd because we have this gap. We have this gap between finding meaning, finding inherent meaning in life, and the notion that God is dead, right? There's no answer. And he really changed the way I thought of the world, right? Because I felt quite existential. I had sort of an existential crisis when I was reading Nietzsche, because he painted a very bleak viewpoint, because he said like, okay, now God is dead, right? There's no meaning. And he didn't really offer a clear answer in order to combat that. But that's why. And that's why I began taking an interest with Camus. Because he concluded that in order for you to combat that issue, is that you should confront this absurdity of existence and rebel against it.
Right?
You rebel against this existence, and then you're able to accept and embrace the absurd,
right?
And then, yeah, and then you can rejoice in actually what life has to offer, right? But always having in the back of your mind that, yeah, that at the end of the day, ultimately, existence is absurd.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've also recently tackled that topic. Like, the book I've been talking to you about, Ikigai.
Yeah.
It's basically a book which pushes you to find meaning in life. So, there's countless of books that actually refer to this certain topic, because everyone wants to, you know, find meaning, right? It makes you peaceful and things like that.
Yeah.
Within life's absurdities. And this book in particular teaches you, or actually leads you, in how to find meaning in life. And what's interesting about it, and why I chose this book in particular compared to any other book that talks about this topic, is because it has some sort of material relevance with regards to the fact that there's a certain region which practices this practice so much in Okinawa, and it's a blue zone. So a blue zone is when there's a lot of centenarians there. There's a lot of people living above 80.
Okay.
And it's considered a blue zone. And obviously people are attracted to that and trying to find what makes it a blue zone. What makes it a blue zone amongst the many other blue zones in the world, there's one in California and Puerto Rico and so on and so forth, is how they live this long, right? And the Japanese actually pinpoint to this ikigai. And there's a lot of constituents to it. One is called flow. So, right?
Yeah.
So flow is a state where you're very much in tune with reality. You're not in your thoughts and you're focused on the moment, and it best uses your muscles and how you react and things like that to the environment without your mind, you know, interfering at all.
Yeah.
So you're completely stuck in this rhythm of motion, completing a task. That's flow. And it's taken actually also in this book. And what's interesting is the way the government also regulates and finds and seeks information about the citizens in this Okinawa place is through an informal practice called moi. So when you grow in Okinawa or you group yourselves in a small group of friends that are actually the rest of your life called moi. So friends that care for each other, friends that listen to each other, friends that try to solve each other's problems. And the government uses that to find information about them, like where they live, their interests and things like that.
Yeah.
Not from them, but they're learning about how they associate themselves intra-governmentally, like in their small friendship community. They're learning and they're using it also as a system to administer them in a database or something. Or looking about information. So they look at moi. So that's a part of ikigai. You need to have this close-knit. You don't really need to. That's just because they're just learning, right?
Yeah.
These people are learning how
they live. Close-knit community.
Like a close-knit community where you feel safe.
You know? Yeah. Where you learn from each other,
you
right?
You learn from each other. You have each other's back. And they're lifelong.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's also from ikigai. So there's flow. There's that. And there's also an interesting rule called the 80% rule. That's with anything you eat. So I know it's hard to imagine your stomach in with regards to capacity of percentage, because it's really hard to, you know, when you eat,
yeah,
to realize how much you're full or how much you need to eat before you reach a certain capacity, right? And they always say once you feel 80% full, you stop eating, right?
Yeah.
And that's also part of ikigai. So at the end of the day, it's
sort of like a protection against overstimulation, right?
Definitely.
And yeah, and if I may interject.
Yeah, go ahead.
What's interesting, right, about what you said is that, yeah, like I also like noticed when I was reading about Albert Camus' works, mm-hmm. is that, yeah, what I realized in, like, I was still troubled by this notion. I was still curious about this notion of what does it exactly mean to embrace existence, right? Right? Mm. What does that mean? And how I found out to combat that was through spirituality,
right?
Right? And how I find that spirituality was primarily to Buddhist meditation practices,
right?
Because, like, relating to what you said, it sort of like tapped into like meditation sort of made me realize that, yeah, there's this flow state within you,
right,
that you can tap into if you're fully present in the moment.
Definitely.
Right? If you're fully present in the moment and you're not influenced by your judgments and your ego. Mm-hmm. You're having an open awareness, right? And how I think and in my opinion, what meditation uncovered for me was that it sort of broke down the illusion of the self, right? Sort of made me realize that there's two forms of ways to experience the world. One is the conscious experience, the moment-to-moment conscious experience, an open awareness,
right,
of your conscious experience. And then there's this judgmental self, this ego within you, mm-hmm. that has judgment over your thoughts,
right,
your actions, and is always planning and reflecting and trying to come up with solutions in order to optimize against its environment, which we can trace back to our evolutionary history.
Right. I mean, the fact that we were before hunter-gatherers and it was much more a plus point to have this feature.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Everything around you is a threat.
Because
you never know. Back then, you didn't know much.
Yeah, exactly. And consciousness is not a prerequisite to existence.
Right.
Right, it's evolution has like sort of determine that, yeah, that consciousness is useful for us, that having this ego, right, this egotistical consciousness is relevant, is useful for us in navigating our environment.
Right.
And yeah, and also, yeah, and this, like, this also is related to what Yuval Noah Harari and his book Sapiens said. Right. And Yuval Noah Harari is a historian, and his book The Sapiens, it explains sort of a brief history of, like, humankind from, like, the very beginning. So, like, when we were still living in a hunter-gatherer society to our society now. And what he was saying is that humankind, like, the cognitive revolution that humankind had, right, it ascended humans to very complex beings, right, to the top of the food chain, and made us have a very large influence of our environment.
Right.
But what we failed to do is that we failed to adjust to our current ecosystem, right? And that's why then we have, like, most of these ingrained desires and biases and these that stem from our egotistical self, stem from, like, still living in a hunter-gatherer society. And that's why I recognize, like, now, like, primarily in this age, is that we should be more aware. We should be more aware of our primary conscious experience, of our open awareness.
Right.
Like the flow state, for example, that Ikigai talks about.
Right. Yeah, and I see a large similarity in tapping into their primary consciousness, you know? And the longing for people to want that more and more now, you know? I'm not sure if it's a part of life, that this certain age that I'm in, we talk about these kind of things more, or is it a phenomenon that is also the same in every generation that it ever, you know, existed?
You mean sort of a revolution?
Revolution, yeah. So it's repeating at every generation. So our kids will have the same face.
No, I think revolutions are very much, it's very much a trend, right?
Right.
In history, history tends to repeat itself, and it's the same with revolutions, whether they be cognitive revolutions, digital revolutions, or just political revolutions, right? No, yeah, and it always has a way to repeat itself, right? And in this day and age, it's more important to tap into this open awareness, because what we're experiencing in this digital age is that we have an information overload. There's a lot of noise, right, that we're experiencing from all this information.
Definitely.
And it's hard to tap into the signal from this noise. But yeah, one of the methods, right, to tap into this, to tap into this is true, entering the flow state,
right.
to be in this primary form of consciousness.
Right. I think there's an important question to be answered here, or actually a viewpoint, in the fact that now, much more than before, like, with technology around us, we should learn how to use technology in order to compartmentalize the noise.
Yeah.
We're still at a phase where we feel as if it's our enemy. You know, like, God damn it, like, I'm procrastinating. No, we need to learn, because technology can compartmentalize your mind, your time.
No.
And it's easier to live.
Yeah, but that's why now there's, like, as technology gets more and more advanced, it sort of has a shift, right? Back then, like, during the Industrial Revolution, technology started off as becoming our tools. Right, in order to construct buildings and produce goods, right? But nowadays, in this digital revolution, now what we're seeing is that we are becoming the tools of technology, right? Our minds and our desires are being shaped
by what we created,
by technology.
So by us.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's why it's sort of absurd in the sense.
Definitely.
Right? And the solution to this, right, is you should embrace your existence, right? You should embrace what, like, Camus espoused, was that you should embrace, like, you should rebel against this absurdity, right?
Right.
whether it's technology or whether it's reality or whether it's existence, you should rebel against this absurdity, but then you should embrace it as well.
Right.
And by embracing it, you experience life in its fullest.
You see the positive behind, actually, it's something that's negative.
Yeah.
So you see the light in everything.
Yeah, like exactly.
That happens through life. Because if you embrace it, you're also accepting and actually unlocking a new viewpoint on its negative.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you can
appreciate that.
Exactly. And that's why. And during this period, right? During this period where I was invested in existentialism, after reading Camus, I began to feel more romantic with the world. I began to romanticize the world, right? Mm. I began to have my own romantic revolution,
right?
And that I became more appreciative of what life has to offer, right? With a lot of activities that we do.
Right.
And that's what's missing from society in this digital age, is that we fail to appreciate what we have, right? We're always longing for optimization in a way.
Right. We're also, because of this, now we're controlled by the media, and the fact that anything that's substreamed into the media can go into the mainstream of our minds. Like, we don't know the future, man. Like, we don't know the new product that's going to come out. So we're always anxious, you know? We're always longing for something better because we don't know what's coming up, you know? We're always anticipating the newer thing. Even it's built in with technology, built in obsolescence and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to chuck this phone away in a year, right, Ron? Or maybe like 3 years, whatever.
Yeah, when it breaks down.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And you're always longing for the next thing.
No, but that's... That's also one of the primary tenets of Buddhism is that life is dukkha, right? And dukkha roughly translates to suffering, but a more apt translation, in my opinion, is unsatisfactoriness.
Right. So basically, like nihilism to an extent with Kant.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, with Nietzsche.
Yeah, because like true evolution, we've been wired to always try to. To always try to optimize our environment, right? Optimize our potential within the environment. And this is where this unsatisfactoriness comes from. We're always longing for something better.
Right. It's actually also the opposite of longing for the past. Reminiscing, you know? So in reality, let's say you've grown in age and you've reached the point where you start longing for the past. In reality... Once you grow older, you realize that the present is what you have.
No, exactly.
And it's sad because that's the only part of life, you know, that you reach a point where you reminisce and you realize, damn, like, the past was good, you know?
No, yeah, and that's...
And I think, yeah.
And that's one of the absurd ways in how our lives are formed and how our lives are developed. We start off like at a young age, oh yeah, I can't wait to have this available, to have these achievements. I'm trying to like achieve those things, right?
Right.
And then at the end of your life, then you sort of reminisce, right? You sort of reminisce at your past, right?
Right.
But then that's why we've become too shrouded in our ego to fully like embrace the present moment,
right?
Because that's essentially the essence of life, right? That's the essence of conscious experience.
That's where you can have actually the only control.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't control the future nor the past.
Exactly. And how you can do that is you just tap into this primary mode. You try to be less shrouded and clouded by your judgments, right? By your egotistical self, by your ego.
Definitely. That's, I think that's the thing. Yeah, but I think it's a phase, you know. At this day and age, when you're young, you're much more, you know, with your ego, you're much more irrational.
Yeah.
You make decisions which are kind of brash sometimes and you don't put much thought into it. That's because the ego is playing a huge role. And I think it's a phase in life, you know. You're young... You don't have a clue what's going on. You're much more present. And then you reach this phase of much more consciousness. And actually, not consciousness, but absorbing different schools of thought. absorbing the information you read, and then you realize actually you're questioning what you experienced when you were younger. Actually, yeah. Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, exactly.
To an extent, you know. To an extent. This is, I think, a what is it? Not a sanction. Not as harsh as a sanction, but I think it's sort of a yeah, like it's a it plays a huge role in giving value, you know. Right, when you're a kid, yeah. you always notice that, you know, you're tapped into reality because you're not thinking much, you don't know much. Ignorance is bliss, right? And that's the sanction of knowledge. You get impounded by this, the fact that actually, you know, I'm starting to learn more, I'm starting to question my existence. And that, you know, the fact that you feel a little bit unsettled, a little bit rebellious, that comes from that, man.
Yeah.
Of knowledge. And then once you get older, you refine this knowledge.
Yeah.
You sort of embrace your own values and you don't care anymore once you're older. You know? That's similar to when you were a kid, and that's why I think this part of life, the way we're tapping into raw knowledge and we can't really question it because we haven't built our own thoughts on it, is a prerequisite why we're aggressive sometimes
with yeah,
irrational decisions.
That's what's interesting, right? When you're a child, you're very curious. You're very much tapped into this this idea, this philosophy of embracing your ignorance, right?
Right.
You're being very curious about how things work, and you're asking questions. You're embracing your ignorance.
Right.
And I guess that's what's sort of been failed nowadays to think about and to think about its importance, right?
Of course.
In order to embrace our ignorance, because that is how we cultivate our minds, right? And by cultivating our minds, then we can, be more appreciative of the knowledge that we've been able to obtain and how our thoughts and ideas are shaped from that.
Right. But you know the old idiom, right? And it rings true, man.
Ignorance is bliss.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
It's the old expression in saying that how humans actually, with not knowing, they give themselves a piece of comfort and peace within themselves to not be anxious of the situation. Or the nice mix of, you know, safeness and soundness in knowing that you won't know of the future events.
No, yeah. And this sort of like ties into like this conception of echo chamber, which is even more like relevant nowadays in this digital age, right? And like what the echo chamber basically describes is that we're all like entrapped in this chamber, right? And this chamber sort of loops our ideas and our thoughts. It feeds it back to itself. It can't leave, right? And no outside influence can enter it to change our minds on things. Right, and it's even more relevant now because now we're becoming sort of like tools from technology, and like it's very apparent in YouTube, for example, like these algorithms. It surveils your data, right? Your watching history, and then it feeds the relevant content back to you. And for example, if say that you are invested and watching a lot of flat earth theory, it would feed that back to you, right? It would feed that back to your suggestions, and that's the whole idea of like this echo chamber.
And it's even harder because it's so deeply ingrained within us, a way of us to get things done, a politics that actually is part of our DNA, is that we use this echo chamber to get things done. In our smaller communities, we get goals achieved through relaying the same information, so everyone has the same piece of doctrine and are willing to do the same thing. It's much easier when everyone is in cohesive unison to achieve a goal, right? And this is why an echo chamber is very hard to break out, because it's been deeply ingrained within our society from the bare bones.
No, exactly. And within these like echo chambers are these myths, right? These myths that we tell ourselves that ground our existence, right?
Right.
And like these ingrained like biases that we have like stem from evolution, right? And then we sort of use these ingrained desires then to like construct these myths in order to govern people, in order to make them cooperate in large numbers.
Right.
And that's why it's very hard to break out of an echo chamber, because there's so much myths, right? And we're so much influence from these myths into our behavior and into our ideas and thoughts.
Right. Definitely.
Yeah.
Because actually, if you think about it, like, it's easier listening and implementing rather than doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because people base their lives off theories, actually.
Yeah, people base their lives on myths, right?
Myths, yeah.
On models of how things should be, like models of governance of and models of reality.
Right.
And like, for example, law is also an echo chamber in which the regulations and the guidelines that are set in place are always like fed back into it. It's very hard to like change the nature and the regulations within that because of the strict echo chamber.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. But then like, what's funny about law is they realize that some parts of information are less strict than others. There's a hierarchy within law. So like the constitution sits on top of that hierarchy. And then you have different series of laws which are ranging from decrees or whatever. And then the lowest ever law from a municipality, for instance, in the Netherlands. Yeah. So they realize that some information are stuck and held bonded, and it's cohesive, such as state ideologies and things like that.
Yeah.
And that is very much less rigid or less fortunate to change.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that is that, like, you can clearly see how ideology and these myths influence the echo chambers. Because if you compare, say, a general, like, ideology of the European Union, which tends to be more liberal if you're in Western Europe, is very different from Afghanistan with the Taliban government.
Of course. And what you generally find with these governments is they're more oppressive, right?
Yeah, so exactly. Even because there's more constraints, right? There's more constraints that you need to follow in order for this system to work.
Right. And what's more is actually it's tapping into fear, actually. The enforcement of the constraints. It's much more severe in Taliban.
Yeah, like, exactly.
You can be hanged, shot, who knows, yeah?
Yeah, for not following those constraints. Right.
So there's also an illusionary element of fear.
Yeah.
From that regime for you breaking out of the echo chamber of law, for instance.
Exactly.
So it's even tighter. And yeah.
Yeah. And that's what's interesting is that, so each individual has, like, in my opinion, each individual has their own echo chamber, right? That's shaped by their environment, their personality, and also the myths that they've. And the myths and the models of reality that they've come to utilize.
Right.
And that's why we have, that's why it's hard to take a step back and truly recognize these ideas and these thoughts for what they are. Because we're always shrouded by this, by this barrier of this echo chamber, right? Which is sometimes it's very hard to penetrate and very hard to change your opinion on things.
Right.
Because it stems back, right, to like the notion of ignorance is bliss, right?
Yeah.
People tend to be more comfortable in their own echo chamber, right? It's easier. They found a method, a mode of living that's comfortable, right, based on their echo chamber.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why it's even say a person was able to escape this echo chamber and change their viewpoint on like a certain ideology that they've been following for their lives. It's also very difficult for that person to influence the people that are in the echo chamber.
Right. And what's also scary from a governmental perspective is how, to varying degrees, governments are becoming more pro the status quo.
How's that?
Pro status quo. Like, for instance, they like big establishment.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, if we look at America and the liberal countries, they really like the establishment being the big brother. You know, this was always thrown around in politics, like big brother, overseeing. looking at every move and things like
that. The big brother of capitalism.
Right. Stuff like that. Yeah, yeah. And this big brother concept actually illustrates how it makes our life easier because there's a big brother looking, you know, you forgot something, you're reminded.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this for this, this for this, this for this. And it, you know, some people find comfort in that actually knowing that there's something out there protecting them. So a similar figure.
Yeah. This sort of like God. This echo chamber protects. Yeah. Right. Protects their well-being, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Right, and that's why it's hard. It's hard for us to embrace our ignorance, right? To sort of try to break down those barriers of the echo chamber that we're residing in.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so sort of digressing from the echo chambers, it sort of also relates to this notion of the state of flow, right?
Right. And I think the state of flow is something you achieve personally because it's also based off your own echo chamber. Like, with regards to what things you find to do that helps you achieve that state of flow, like working perhaps, or like playing sports or whatever, it's different from one person to another, right? But yeah, I think the state of flow is very important now because people are in search of more and more productivity. Like how to be much more productive because you actually, you know, time is becoming much more relative now.
Yeah.
Like you have much less and less time because humans are getting much and more frantic with their daily lives. So it's becoming relative in construing that relative.
Yeah. And like the problem nowadays is because we're having like this information overload, right? It's hard to capture like the signal from the noise. It's hard to like, find a mode of living in which we feel fulfilled and we feel happy, right?
Yeah.
And the key idea, right, of tapping into the flow is, yeah, because what the flow is it just like this open awareness, right? Without judgment of like without judgment of the ego on conscious experience.
Right. And it's also it's also actually the flow is also a sense of purpose in what you should be doing, man. Like, if you have flow in that, then you have, you know, you should be doing that much, much more. Because flow is also interconnected to how we feel and things.
No, exactly. And life is but a series of moments, a series of moment-to-moment conscious experience, right? That is the present moment. And that's and we are always living in the present moment. Right. We are never living in the past and we're never living in the future, despite what our ego is telling us about reminiscing and planning for the future.
Right.
Yeah, and tapping into like this flow state is very rewarding at the same time. And how I like experience that is through sports, meditation, and doing creative things, doing creative aspects that that stimulate my mind. Like for example, reading or writing. Those things make me enter a flow state in which I have potential to like unleash or utilize like
version.
Like the best version and my creative freedom, right? Where there's less constraints,
true.
And less judgment from my ego.
Yeah, and actually, flow is somewhat there's a general like benchmark on how to achieve it actually and like I'm not sure of the principles, but I got this from the book The Ikigai, and I know one of them is, you know, you have to be free of distractions and try to control your emotions through meditation, for instance, when you want to achieve, you know, if you control your emotions you can navigate them and you can compartmentalize them. It doesn't necessarily dissipate, but it's there, and it's there for a later, you know, you approach it later.
No,
but
exactly.
The more you can compartmentalize, the more better you'll reach the flow.
Yeah, exactly. Because
and one task at a time, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Because how I see it, right, is that there's like I said previously, is that there's like two modes of consciousness,
right?
And yeah, and when you're achieving the flow, you're in that mode of open awareness, right? And that's where you can truly embrace and rejoice in like what life has to offer it, which Camus proposed in his philosophy of absurdism.
Right. Yeah.
How about you? Like when do you feel like you're entering like a flow state?
Right. I mean, to be honest with you, I've only reached, I think there's like tangents to the flow state.
Okay.
There's like levels to it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have to be honest with you, I haven't been in a flow state to a full extent that much, but I have been in miniature flow state.
Yeah.
Like when I study, let's say 2 hours, I'll probably reach in a flow state, maybe 70% of that time or 50% sometimes, yeah. depending on a lot of different factors, the distractions, yeah. and how the day went and things like that. And what I ate, actually, believe it or not, because the more and more I'm more conscious in my body, the more and more I actually need for the flow state to control, like, for instance, my food, my water intake, you know, my distractions. I think these proponents help me to reach a flow state.
Yeah.
And honestly, anything I do, because there's a beginning phase. It's sort of like running on a treadmill. The beginning phase is you're charting along and you're counting every step and counting every mile.
Yeah.
And you feel as if, you know, it's so far away.
Because of your ego, right?
Your ego.
Right. That's your concerned ego. With like planning and like, okay, what do you want to achieve?
Right. That's true.
Right?
That's true.
Yeah.
But then you need to realize that you need to take it one revolution at a time. You need to take it one step at a time. And then you'll realize that actually the reading, the first part of it, the first few paragraphs, you're still in your mind and things. And then afterward, it flows.
Yeah, exactly. Afterward, it takes time. It takes time and it takes patience.
Right.
Right? But it is, yeah, it is very much achievable.
Definitely.
It's very much achievable. And that's, I guess what's been left out and what's been not as touted as significant as much in society because of all this noise that we're experiencing with all this information nowadays.
Right, right. So the reason why I brought that up is because the way I see the flow state as a mechanism to achieve it allows me freedom into getting flow state in anything. Like, for instance, with the guitar, at first I was like, you know, not enjoying it.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I abridged like a flow state.
Yeah.
And it was nice. But then the thing is, things which are I'm much more interested in, I'll have a greater flow state. For instance, sports. Like, I have a much greater flow state and possibility to be in a flow state with sports. Like, for instance, rugby, football. But then with that being said, I've only had it a few times. Because I think sometimes with the flow state, it gets better and better sometimes, and then you lose track of the past flow states, like, because this one's so good,
you didn't know if the past was
a flow state or you just playing.
Yeah, I mean, the ideal situation, right, is that you're never reminiscing on past flow states because you want to be fully present at the moment, right?
No, but that's my introspection self.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I'm thinking like, I was present in that moment,
yeah,
but then I got another flow state.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I realized like, all right, wait, did I really appreciate that past flow state?
Exactly. But that means, right, when you're looking back at it, if you were truly like present in that moment, then it's harder to like memorize exactly what you did because you've had an open awareness. Right?
No. You memorize what you did.
You memorize.
Yeah, because they're memorable. You take what you were given.
It's memorable, but what's not memorable is the exact
the details,
the exact experience that you felt.
Right.
Right. The exact experience. Ah. You have the picture of it, right? The conception, the representation of it.
But it's hard, yeah.
Yeah, but it's hard to fully capture it again.
Yeah, true.
But that's why. But that's the ideal situation because then you want to be like fully like appreciative of the moment, right?
Yeah. So that, yeah, it's like sports for me, and then with school, yeah, sometimes I get submerged in the reading.
Yeah.
And you go quick and stuff. And then it also depends on how much input I have.
No, yeah. And
actually.
Yeah, and how much input you have, right, is determined by like your echo chamber.
Right.
Like, it determines how much like sources of like inspiration or insight comes,
right,
and that's what develops your thinking.
True. Yeah. So that was it. Like sports, generally football, reading for sure, and sometimes doing schoolwork.
Yeah.
Yeah. That brings my flow. Some walking.
Yeah.
Walking, and then walking. I'll experience a change in like how I perceive things.
Yeah.
Like, it's much more joyous, or you feel accomplished.
You're more present.
I'm more present afterwards. Yeah. Because Actually, that's why sometimes I think walking is kind of short term. Because, for instance, you were feeling like really shitty because you didn't do your day.
Yeah.
Or you didn't do anything. And then you go on a walk and then it's a short term. Okay. Like, I felt good after the walk. I did something. I accomplished. But yeah, it's not settling this problem of like, you haven't finished any of your work in life. Like, you have some schoolwork, but you decide to dip for a walk, right?
Yeah.
And then you come back and you're like, and then you can do the schoolwork, you know?
No, exactly.
Like, you feel accomplished. It's a mood boost. It's a confidence
boost. No, exactly. Then, like,
but you gotta keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. It's, yeah, it's a practice, right?
And, yeah. And it's a routine.
It's a routine that you have to develop. And right, you develop that, yeah, I guess, by, like, optimizing, like, certain, like, elements in your environment. Yeah, yeah. And, like, also your way of thinking, yeah, and your judgment
things. Right. So we share a lot in common with regards to the flow state then.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, because I would say, like, yeah, everyone can experience the flow state.
Definitely.
It's something that's achievable for everybody.
Right.
Achieving, like, an open awareness is achievable for everybody. You just need to be more, you just need to break down those barriers of judgment that you're having on things.
Right. And also sometimes simplify the way you do things, man. Like multitasking, for instance, you cut that down, you know, and you know, unless you're like a select few adept, but I reckon most of the population is not attuned to multitasking, man.
No, and it's very, it's very difficult to attend to two items at the same time.
Of course, bro. And if you think about it, the more focused you are on one item, you'll get it done quick, and then you can move on to the next one. And you'll get it done same time as multitasking, but with 100% effort.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And that's exactly what you're doing.
Right.
And that's, we're doing that in terms of like doing tasks, but we fail to do that for our mind, right? Right. We have failed to like appreciate our mind, right? Our conscious experience. We fail to do that. Because that's essentially what it does. Having like this open awareness, actually like, makes you more clear. Makes you have a more inner clarity within your mind,
right.
Which allows you to enjoy more experiences in your life, to be fully appreciated.
Right. True. Yeah.
And
we ended there. That was our first episode.
That was our first discussion.
Definitely.
It. It was very enjoyable. Enjoyable. Thanks, Ron. Thank you as well, John. But yeah, before closing, but also like to, talk about what our next podcast will be about.
So the next podcast, since we gave a description of ourselves now, we must give a description to the title.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the title plays a lot into why we would open a podcast about with the name Plato's Cave. Plato's Cave is an elementary level on how to look at life. Bro.
No, exactly. How
to perceive life and its absurdity.
Exactly.
It's an elementary version, and it should be one of those fundamentals, like in law.
Yeah,
like exactly. In science with, like, you know, equations to an extent.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, it's a fundamental way in thinking.
No, because for me, in my opinion, Plato's Cave is what describes anything you experience and you think about,
right?
That is, for me, one of the primary tenets of life, of existence, is that we are living in Plato's cave.
Definitely. And like, yeah, and that'll be the next episode.
Yeah, and that's it. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. See you next time.